established pillar of science. Reporters love to ask, was Einstein wrong, or do we need to rethink Darwin? Journalism failure number 4 is reporting on a scientific concept that Crouch clearly doesn't understand. This is where science journalists really need to interview experts, and not just to mine them for quotes, but also to check their own understanding of a topic. Further, they should interview experts not involved in the paper on which they are reporting, to see if the scientist is a lone crank or in the mainstream. Crouch continues to push his clickbait narrative. Professor Robertson stressed that genes remain the blueprint for a new baby, but said the work of both Darwin and Lamarck may need to be reconsidered. The genes are the blueprint, and that won't change, Professor Robertson said. But this is at another level. It is the decoration of the gene, the icing on the cake, if you like, a gift to offspring that gives them another layer of information about survival. She says nothing about Darwin and Lamarck, just like the review says nothing about Darwin and Lamarck. The statements that the author uses to support his interpretation, in fact, contradict it. Epigenetics is another level of information, which doesn't change the basic fact that genes are the blueprint. As an aside, I don't like the blueprint metaphor for genes. It's misleading. Genes are not a blueprint. There is no representation of the final product in the genes. Genes, rather, are more of a recipe, a set of instructions that, if followed, result in the final organism. Yes, this is nitpicking, but metaphors in science communication should strive to be conceptually accurate. Epigenetics is not a new concept, as one might think from reading Crouch's article, but it is still relatively young, scientifically speaking, and there is likely scant public awareness of the field. Reporting on this review was a good and missed opportunity to introduce readers to the concept of epigenetics and put it into some historical and scientific perspective. Anyone reading Crouch's piece who is not already familiar with evolutionary theory and epigenetics wouldn't have come away with any real insight, but rather completely misinformed. That's a good overall marker for the quality of a piece of science journalism. Will the average reader be better educated about the relevant issues or confused and misled? Good science journalism would even go the extra step of anticipating common myths, tropes, or misconceptions, and correcting them. Here's Crouch's headline. Darwin's Theory of Evolution Challenged by University of Adelaide Genetic Memory Research, published in Journal Science. Here's the real headline. Local scientists write a review article on a decades-old concept of epigenetics. Okay, not so exciting, but you get my point. Section 4. Death by Pseudoscience. Among the most difficult types of emails we receive from listeners of the show are those that are essentially pleas for help. They are often from people who have a loved one who is ill and, in desperation, is falling prey to dangerous quackery. We hear from people who are trying to deal with a spouse who does not want to vaccinate their children, or perhaps their family member is just obsessed with some pseudoscience and is wasting their time and money chasing a fantasy. We frequently hear direct stories of the harm that a belief in nonsense can bring, so we take it very seriously when we are also frequently asked about belief in magic. What's the harm? The implication is, and sometimes a listener states this explicitly, so what if people believe in ghosts or aliens? Let people have their fun or comforting beliefs. You're just going around popping people's bubbles. Do you tell young children that Santa Claus doesn't exist? No. If you're reading this guide, you likely want to think for yourself and be purged of misinformation, sloppy thinking, and false beliefs. But if you also want to believe in magic and fairy tales, go right ahead. Personally, I like separating my entertaining fantasy from reality. As skeptics, we don't get too involved in what people believe. Seriously, what you believe is a personal matter that happens inside your head. Where scientific skepticism gets involved is when people make claims, have a pretense to knowledge, or state something as a fact, or as if it's a valid conclusion of logic or science. If you make any such claims, you are stepping into the arena of science, so don't complain if you are held to its clearly posted rules. Okay, They may not be clearly posted, but they are there and will happily point them out. We also get involved when people try to impose their beliefs on others or say that we should run society according to their beliefs. If you think your beliefs should hold sway, then questioning the basis for those beliefs is fair. Also, part of our mission is consumer protection. There is a lot of fraud and potential harm out there, and for those who want to protect themselves, we offer our critical analysis of specific claims and guidelines for how to avoid being scammed. One of those guidelines is not to fall for the notion that there is no potential harm to believing that fantasy or nonsense is real. We live in a complex world and have to make a lot of complex decisions, individually, as a family or small group, and collectively as a society. We're better off if those decisions are based on reality. The "what's the harm" question is itself potentially harmful, because it trivializes the real challenge people face trying to understand complex questions that inform important decisions. It also whitewashes, and even excuses, the direct harm done by many con artists and charlatans. There are countless dramatic examples of harm, even fatal harm, coming from believing that fantasy is real. That's why one of our informal segments on the SGU is called Death by Pseudoscience, to occasionally highlight some of those examples. There may be no harm in believing in magic, but there can be from acting on it. The more exposure these cautionary tales get, perhaps the fewer emails we'll receive from desperate listeners. Chapter 52. Death by Naturopathy. Naturopathy is nothing more than a hodgepodge of mostly unscientific treatment modalities based on vitalism and other pre-scientific notions of disease. David Gorski. You don't often hear of heart attacks in 30-year-old women, especially those whose primary medical complaint is eczema, an itchy yet otherwise benign skin rash. So when Jade Eric lost her life in March 2017, the San Diego medical examiner went to work. The official cause of death was found to be anoxic encephalopathy due to prolonged resuscitated cardiopulmonary arrest due to adverse reaction to infused turmeric solution. Yes, you heard that correctly. An intravenous infusion of turmeric caused a young, otherwise healthy woman to have a heart attack, and while she was down, her brain was starved of oxygen, and she died. For those of you unfamiliar with the aromas and flavors of Indian cuisine, turmeric is a spice often used in making curry, and it can be found in dishes all over the Middle and Far East. It has a yellow-orange tint and a wonderfully aromatic, slightly bitter taste. It is frequently used in place of pricier saffron or blended with other spices. But turmeric is a food, not a drug. The spice is made from the plant Curcuma longa, and although it's been used in traditional Ayurvedic, a system of treatment common in India, practices for thousands of years, modern science has shown little promise for its efficacy. A recent review in the Journal of Medical Chemistry looked at over 120 clinical trials of curcumin, the major chemical component of turmeric. The authors conclude, no double-blinded, placebo-controlled clinical trial of curcumin has been successful. Curcumin is an unstable, reactive, non-bioavailable compound and, therefore, a highly improbable lead. Curcumin is an experimental agent. It isn't FDA-approved to prevent or treat any disease. In fact, the FDA listed curcumin on its website as one of 187 fake cancer cures consumers should avoid. Curcumin is a good example of why you should be generally skeptical of herbal remedies. Curcumin has almost no bioavailability, which means no active ingredients get into the blood, where they can have an effect. Further, curcumin has properties that cause it to react to many experimental assays. So if you're testing it in a petri dish, it seems to do everything. When you give it to animals or people, it does nothing. Yet in the unregulated, pseudoscientific world of naturopathy, turmeric is a magical panacea. Most notably, it's touted as a powerful anti-inflammatory agent, with properties claimed to treat not only pain but also stomach, skin, liver, and gallbladder problems, arthritis, fatigue, cancer, colitis, diabetes, and even Alzheimer's. But this type of cure-all rhetoric is hardly specific to turmeric. Naturopaths have a long and storied history of promoting quack cures with no scientific backing. The American Association of Naturopathic Physicians defines naturopathy as a distinct primary healthcare profession, emphasizing prevention, treatment, and optimal health through the use of therapeutic methods and substances that encourage individuals' inherent self-healing process. Quackwatch defines naturopathy as a largely pseudoscientific approach riddled with quackery. Modern naturopathy reared its head in America around the turn of the 20th century, and as of this writing, 18 states offer legal licensure to certified practitioners. Most states deny prescriptive and surgical authority to naturopathic practitioners, and they disqualify them from using the term, quote, physician. This doesn't, however, prevent them from calling themselves doctors, a distinction many prospective patients are unlikely to make. In Colorado, naturopaths can suture wounds. In Oregon, Montana, Utah, and Washington, they may use local anesthesia. In Vermont, they can perform episiotomy and perineal repair associated with naturopathic childbirth. And in California, a naturopathic doctor may utilize routes of administration that include oral, nasal, auricular, ocular, rectal, vaginal, transdermal, intradermal, subcutaneous, intravenous, and intramuscular. This brings us back to Jade Eric, dead at 30 by turmeric infusion. The naturopath responsible has been named by the San Diego Medical Examiner as Kim Kelly, whose archived website includes the following boast. I am excited to announce that I've started administering intravenous curcumin. People have used it to help with pain, inflammation, immune system, arthritis, liver conditions, and cancer. It's also been found that intravenous curcumin, in combination with vitamin C and glutathione, I call it the mother of all antioxidants, has a potentiating effect in helping people with chronic health conditions, such as hepatitis C, liver fibrosis. If you are suffering from any type of inflammatory condition, whether it be arthritis, autoimmune condition, such as scleroderma, lupus, or rheumatoid arthritis, Alzheimer's, or dementia, this may be a great modality of treatment to try. The safety, tolerability, and non-toxicity of curcumin at high doses have been well established by human clinical trials. Promising effects have been observed in patients with various pro-inflammatory diseases. No evidence is provided to back up his claims. Even the website for the National Institutes of Health's National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health, historically sympathetic towards naturopathy and its practices, says, claims that curcuminoids found in turmeric help to reduce inflammation aren't supported by strong studies. Naturopath-turned-skeptic and journalist Britt Marie Hermes has written at length about both Ms. Eric's particular case and the harms perpetrated by naturopathy at large, stating, naturopathic doctors frequently offer treatments that have not been fully vetted for safety or effectiveness, and many therapies used in naturopathic practice have been disproved by rigorous trials. This is likely the result of naturopathic education blurring the line between treatments backed by good evidence and practices using, quote, natural substances that turn profits. Common pseudoscientific practices promoted by naturopaths include homeopathy, detoxification, biotherapeutic drainage, chiropractic, supplements and nutraceuticals, colon hydrotherapy, iridology, chelation, acupuncture, and Rolfing, among others. Most alarming, Ms. Hermes points out, is another form of intravenous therapy, oxygenation therapy using ozone gas or hydrogen peroxide, both of which can and have killed. They are not backed by sound science, nor are they FDA approved, or legal for that matter. Oxygenation therapy is a good illustration of how incoherent naturopathic philosophy can be. Ozone is described by the FDA as a toxic gas with no known useful medical application in specific, adjunctive, or preventive therapy. Simply put, ozone is O3, three oxygen atoms bound together. It's a highly reactive oxygen molecule with two potential effects, providing more oxygen to tissues and using oxidative reactions to kill bacteria, viruses, and cancer cells. Therapies involving hydrogen peroxide, H2O2, follow a similar reasoning. This is ironic because it flies in the face of the whole antioxidant craze, and it brings up a major weakness of that fad. Oxygen and oxygen-free radicals are a two-edged sword. Tissues need oxygen, and they use oxygen-free radicals as part of the immune system to kill invaders. But the free radicals also damage host tissue. So there needs to be a delicate balance. Pushing this balance in one direction or the other with antioxidants, ozone, or hydrogen peroxide is unlikely to provide side effect-free benefits and may cause more harm than good. That said, ozone and hydrogen peroxide do have legitimate uses as a surface sterilizer and external disinfectant, mainly topical, dental, or on blood products. In the laboratory, ozone has been shown to inactivate HIV, but so do many other things that aren't useful in therapy. These so-called treatments are ineffective against cancer, HIV, multiple sclerosis, or the myriad other disease states their naturopathic practitioners claim they cure. The further claim that they detoxify the body is pure pseudoscience. Nonspecific detoxification itself is a scam, whether by oxygenation or any other method. Although it's impossible to tally the overall number of casualties involved, there are multiple documented deaths from ingestion or intravenous infusion of oxygenation products. And although neither hydrogen peroxide nor ozone are legal to administer by naturopaths, the therapies continue. In fact, as recently as December 2015, the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians offered continuing education credits for a webinar called Clinical Applications of Medical Ozone Therapy. Ozone therapies are just as lacking in rationale and evidence as the IV turmeric that caused the death of Ms. Eric. Both are examples of the absence of a good science-based standard among naturopaths. They eschew science and evidence for philosophy, the appeal to nature fallacy, and their own anecdotal experience and wisdom. But they still want the patina of science because it sells well. This kind of approach leads them to embrace treatments like curcumin that have misleading basic science studies but negative or lacking clinical trials. Of course, even legitimate treatments can sometimes cause harm. That's why real medicine is based on a careful and evidence-based risk versus benefit approach. You can't do a risk versus benefit analysis, however, unless you have some statistics about both. This only comes from rigorous clinical studies in the context of scientific plausibility. Carefully considering the science and evidence can be hard work. It's much easier to just go with instincts. Naturopaths essentially shoot from the hip, and sometimes they shoot to kill. Chapter 53. Exorcism. Medieval beliefs yield medieval results. Nothing in life is to be feared. It is only to be understood. Now is the time to understand more, so that we may fear less. Marie Curie. The skeptical, critical thinking, and scientific principles outlined in this audiobook are like the rungs of a long ladder that humanity has used to climb laboriously out of the swamp of superstition, bias, hubris, and magical belief. We tend to look back now at medieval beliefs and congratulate ourselves for being born in a later age. But not every individual or even every institution has followed our best thinkers out of the muck. We all need to climb the ladder for ourselves. It does seem amazing that in the 21st century, there are still those who embrace the worst possible nonsense that infected our thinking in more primitive times. And yet belief in things like demons and possession continues in some quarters, victimizing those who get caught in this web of ignorance, often innocent children. An exorcism is a religious ceremony, ritual, or practice to rid a person, a place, or an object of a demon, a devil, or some other evil spiritual entity believed to be inhabiting it. A person, place, or object is said to be, quote, possessed if they're deemed to have been so infected. Due to the popularity of the book and the movie, The Exorcist, exorcism tends to be associated with Christianity in the minds of most people from Western cultures. However, exorcism isn't exclusive to the cache of religions under the Christian canopy. Exorcism is practiced as part of Islam, Hinduism, Judaism, and Taoism, to name a few. The Roman Catholic Church believes in diabolic possession, and its priests still practice what is called real exorcism, a 27-page ritual to drive out evil spirits. The ritual involves the use of holy water, incantations, various prayers, incense, relics, and Christian symbols such as the cross. Interest in exorcisms has actually been increasing in recent years. There are 500 to 600 Catholic exorcists worldwide. In the U.S., the number increased from 12 to 50 between 2006 and 2016. There is no central database of how many exorcisms are performed, but one active priest, Father Gary Thomas, the official exorcist of the Diocese of San Jose in Northern California, claims to have performed 50 to 60 exorcisms over that 10-year period. While there are official rules and regulations for performing the exorcism ritual, and officially recognized exorcists who follow them, there are plenty of unqualified members of any given church who unofficially take it upon themselves to perform exorcisms. In many of these cases, it's the parishioners and worshipers, the most fervent believers in diabolic possession, who take it upon themselves to determine that a person might be possessed and that they, being the hardcore devotees of the religion, are capable of exorcising the evil forces from the possessed one. And why not? In the case of Roman Catholicism, the concepts of possession and exorcism emanate from the highest authority, the Pope. In 1999, the Vatican did update its 1614 guidelines for expelling demons. It only took 385 years to see the necessity of updating, urging exorcists to avoid mistaking psychiatric illness for possession. It is debatable if these updates have had the desired effect. As paranormal investigator Joe Nickel pointed out in his February 2001 article in the Skeptical Inquirer on the subject of exorcisms, belief in spirit possession flourishes in times and places where there is ignorance about mental states. Citing biblical examples, the medieval church taught that demons were able to take control of an individual, and by the 16th century, demonic behavior had become relatively stereotypical. It manifested itself by convulsions, prodigious strength, insensitivity to pain, temporary blindness or deafness, clairvoyance, and other abnormal characteristics. Some early notions of possession may have been fomented by three brain disorders: epilepsy, migraine, and Tourette's syndrome. Psychiatric historians have long attributed demonic manifestations to such aberrant mental conditions as schizophrenia and hysteria, noting that, as mental illness began to be recognized as such after the 17th century, there was a consequent decline in demonic superstitions. While the Church professes to rule out psychiatric or neurological disorders before declaring someone truly demon-afflicted, this isn't really possible. In the end, their evidence is the behavior of the person, who among other things could simply be acting out what they believe a possession should look like. Sometimes belief in possession is based entirely in others, not the person allegedly possessed. These innocent people become the victims of abuse, torture, and death by exorcism. Here are just a few gruesome examples. In 2014, Zakiah Avery of Germantown, Maryland, mother of four children aged 8, 5, 2, and 1, stabbed and choked her two youngest children to death in front of the two older children. She then stabbed the two older children. She told investigators that evil spirits were moving between the bodies of the children, and with the help of an adult housemate, she had attempted to exorcise the spirits. In 2012, four women from South Africa, Fundiswa Faku, Lindela Jalobane, Nokubonga Jalobane, and Nolanla Mdeleshi, attempted to exorcise a demon from Faku's 15-year-old cousin, Sinathemba Dlamini. In the fervor and struggling of the victim, she succumbed to death only after her intestines were ripped from her body through her vagina. In 1976, one of the most famous cases of death by exorcism, Anneliese Michel of Germany, was documented. Annalise's story is dramatized in the films The Exorcism of Emily Rose, 2005, Requiem, 2006, and Annalise, The Exorcist Tapes, 2011. Her parents had become convinced that Annalise was possessed by demons. She was epileptic and previously had been treated for depression. Despite this, the parents called upon the services of two priests to perform the exorcism ritual. She died several months later, the cause of death determined to be dehydration and malnutrition. Her parents, with the guidance of the priests, effectively caused her to stop eating and drinking, and Annalise slowly died a horrific, prolonged death. A court found the parents and priests guilty of manslaughter. Even when exorcism doesn't lead to death, there is tremendous potential for harm. Perhaps the worst thing you could do to a delusional psychiatric patient, for example, is to confirm their delusions. Telling them they are actually possessed by demons will simply exacerbate their illness, severing any tenuous attachment they have to reality. It would be like telling a paranoid patient that the CIA really is listening to their thoughts through the fillings in their teeth. This torture is inflicted because of so-called evidence presented for possession, which is always entirely unconvincing. I have seen many exorcisms recorded on tape, and always the victim is either doing nothing extraordinary or doing a very bad job of auditioning for the sequel to The Exorcist. Never do we see anything preternatural or even slightly compelling. There never has been a single proven case of possession in recorded history, and yet there are millions, arguably billions, of people living today who have no problem accepting the ideas of possession and exorcism as being real. This is what the world is like, with some skeptical principles as a guide and caution. While demons and devils may not exist, people's ability to do great harm in the name of nonsense is all too real. Chapter 54. Death by Denial. Science is a way to teach how something gets to be known, what is not known, to what extent things are known, for nothing is known absolutely, how to handle doubt and uncertainty, what the rules of evidence are, how to think about things so that judgments can be made, how to distinguish truth from fraud, and from show. Richard Feynman. Sometimes harm comes from embracing pseudoscience, and sometimes it comes from denying established science. One of the most pernicious and frustrating manifestations of the latter is HIV denial. On June 5, 1981, the CDC published a report of 5 cases of a rare pneumonia, PCP pneumonia, in 5 otherwise healthy young gay men. In 1982, it was recognized that these and other patients were suffering from an immune deficiency syndrome and opportunistic infections. In 1983, a retrovirus was discovered as the probable cause of this new syndrome, AIDS, acquired immunodeficiency syndrome. The virus was initially called lymphadenopathy-associated virus, but was later renamed human immunodeficiency virus, HIV. In 1985, the first blood test for HIV was approved, and in 1987, the FDA approved the first drug for the treatment and prevention of HIV, AZT. Over the next 20 years, scientists developed what is called highly active antiretroviral therapy, or HART, treatment. It is a cocktail of drugs designed to interfere with HIV at multiple steps in its infection and replication. As these drugs continue to be developed, the life expectancy of those with HIV increases. By 2013, data showed that those with HIV who start HART treatment early have essentially a normal life expectancy. In 30 years, HIV went from a short-term death sentence to a manageable chronic illness. There have been only a few cures of HIV, meaning that those with a documented infection are now virus-free after treatment. One such cure was effected with a bone marrow transplant, another with high-dose HART in an infant infected at birth. These approaches will likely not be applicable to most patients with HIV. Research into an HIV vaccine is ongoing. HIV is particularly challenging for various reasons. It mutates throughout the infection, it evades the immune system, and it can hide in a dormant state. The best we've done so far is a phase 3 trial showing 31% efficacy in preventing initial infection. This is a modest result, but it shows we are making progress. In short, HIV is one of the stunning success stories of modern medicine. Science rapidly discovered the nature and cause of AIDS. We've had a steady increase in our understanding of this virus. It is now a manageable disease, and we continue to make progress towards a vaccine and even a possible cure. This obvious success has not prevented people from denying the science. In the 1980s, HIV denial, denying that HIV was a real virus that was primarily responsible for AIDS, was unjustified pseudoscience. But the deniers could legitimately point to the fact that existing treatments were not very effective. The real test of any scientific theory is how useful it is going forward. Does it make useful predictions? In the case of medicine, does it lead to useful treatments or other interventions? Essentially, we conducted a meta-experiment. If HIV was actually the cause of AIDS, then the research derived from that premise would likely bear fruit. We would expect to deepen our understanding of AIDS and hopefully develop treatments that were increasingly effective. The deniers predicted that HIV was a scientific dead end, and we would only worsen outcomes by exposing AIDS patients to toxic drugs that were of no use. In the last 3 decades, it has become clear that the HIV theory is not only viable, it's a remarkable success. Drugs designed specifically to target the mechanisms of HIV have had dramatic clinical benefits for patients. HIV denial seemed to wane a bit in the late 1990s and early 2000s, because the older crop of deniers were, to be blunt, dying off. It was also difficult to recruit new deniers, given how effective the standard treatment was becoming. In 2009, Christine Maggiore, founder of HIV denialist group Alive and Well AIDS Alternatives, died of pneumonia, likely as a complication of HIV. Before her death, Maggiore's dedication to HIV denial had other tragic consequences. She decided to breastfeed both her children, despite the fact that breastfeeding increases the risk of contracting the virus. Her daughter, Eliza, died at the age of 3, apparently from pneumonia that was likely an opportunistic infection due to advanced AIDS. Maggiore never had her children tested or treated for HIV. Her pediatrician, interestingly, was anti-vaxxer Dr. J. Gordon. He claims to support the conclusion that HIV causes AIDS, but his website used to contain some squirrely comments on HIV that suggested he may have some denialist sympathies. The autopsy report is unequivocal. There was strong evidence that Eliza had an advanced case of AIDS from HIV, including AIDS encephalitis, brain infection. Her cause of death was pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, PCP pneumonia, caused by AIDS. This is a common opportunistic infection in AIDS, but it's extremely rare in an immunocompetent individual. The autopsy left no reasonable doubt that Eliza died from complications of AIDS. Maggiore never acknowledged that her daughter's death was due to HIV or AIDS. The HIV denial community rallied around her, claiming the death was due to an allergic reaction to amoxicillin. Denial is a powerful thing. But denial doesn't just affect individuals. When denialism occurs at a government level, the harm can be magnified thousands of times. There is an AIDS epidemic in Africa, with estimates as high as 10% of the population being affected. Efforts to fight it are hampered by the endemic social problems of that continent. Chief among them is a lack of sufficient modern health resources, but this is greatly exacerbated by a history of HIV denial, especially in South Africa, where it is estimated that 18.8% of the adult population is infected with HIV. From 1999 to 2008, Thabo Mbeki was president of South Africa, and during his tenure he maintained doubt about HIV as the cause of AIDS and dramatically harmed efforts to control and treat HIV in his country. Problems began in 2000 when he announced that he was unconvinced as to the true cause of AIDS. He then put together a panel to explore the issue, packing it with HIV deniers. Most prominent among them was Peter Duisberg, a German-American molecular biologist who doubts the role of HIV in causing AIDS. They, of course, confirmed his denial. Acting on this doubt, his government denied heart medications to patients with HIV. Mbeki delayed and cut funding for testing, medication, and other treatments. He also appointed the health minister, Manto Tshabalala Msimang, sympathetic to his position. Tshabalala Msimang used politics as cover for what were essentially pseudoscientific positions. For example, she warned that we cannot use Western models of protocols for research and development, a convenient way to use national and cultural pride to deny science. Instead of proven, quote, Western therapies, she favored indigenous medicine, such as garlic and beetroot extracts, to treat HIV. These treatments, which were not based on any scientific plausibility, proved worthless. When challenged about the lack of evidence to support beetroot and other such treatments, she again criticized Western medicine for being bogged down in clinical trials. Doing research only delayed getting effective treatments to patients, she argued. This is, sadly, not an uncommon position, as if we can only rely on anecdotes and tradition to determine what works, and any scientific trials are just a waste of time. As a clear demonstration of how political the issue has become, in 2004, Mbeki characterized AIDS as a disease of racism. Writing for the New York Times, Roger Cohen summarized Mbeki's position as being that HIV/AIDS was, quote, a fabrication foisted on Africans by whites determined to distract the continent from real problems of racism and poverty and accepted by blacks afflicted with the slave mentality engendered by apartheid. The deputy health minister, Nozizwe Mandala Rutledge, tried to mitigate these disastrous policies by finding ways of providing effective treatment to South Africans with HIV. In response, Mbeki fired her. A 2008 study by Pride Chigwedere and others found that the policies of Mbeki between 2000 and 2005 resulted in more than 330,000 premature deaths, with a loss of 2.2 million person years, the number of years those who died collectively would have lived. Further, 35,000 babies were born with HIV that could have been avoided with standard treatments. That is a lot of death by pseudoscience. There is a somewhat happy ending to the story. While nothing can reverse the unfortunate losses and ruined lives from Mbeki's science denial, he did leave office in 2008. His successor appointed a new health minister, Barbara Hogan, who immediately reversed Mbeki's policies on HIV/AIDS and started providing treatment to patients. There is no denying the danger of pseudoscience and denial. This extends beyond HIV and AIDS. There are still those who deny the germ theory of disease, that vaccines are safe and effective, or that chemotherapy can be an effective option for certain cancers. The tobacco industry did its best to deny the connection between smoking and lung cancer. The denial of mental illness leaves many vulnerable individuals untreated. It is especially tragic when we have the science, we did the research, did the hard work, and have real solutions for people who need them. But stubbornness and ideology can't help but get in the way. Chapter 55. Suffer the Children. Isn't this enough? Just this world, just this beautiful, complex, wonderfully unfathomable natural world, how does it so fail to hold our attention that we have to diminish it with the invention of cheap, man-made myths and monsters? Tim Minchin. What could possibly motivate a parent to harm their own child, to withhold from them needed medical care, to watch them suffer and even die when help is available? As a parent myself, I find it unfathomable, and yet it happens all too often. As you might guess by now, it only takes an alluring narrative or a compelling anecdote coupled with a lack of critical thinking to create such heart-rending tragedies. What is especially painful about such cases is how wide-ranging the harm can be and how profound the failure of those who should have protected the victims. Parents, of course, are often the focal point of bad decision-making. Because of religious beliefs, sometimes just being enamored of New Age thinking, or maybe a little too suspicious of the mainstream, they fail to provide the basic medical care that it is every parent's duty to provide for all their children. Often there are practitioners involved too. Preachers shaming the parents into not losing faith, or practitioners of dubious medical treatments making unfounded promises. There may also be regulators who fail to make the child's interest paramount and effectively allow the parents to neglect them. Sadly, there are many examples we could give, but here is one to show how the power of belief can bring a parent to neglect or harm their own child. When Candace Newmaker was 10 years old, she was wrapped tightly in a flannel sheet. Three adults, including her adoptive mother, Jean, stood by and taunted her as she struggled to break free from this restricting cocoon. Also present were Connell Watkins and Julie Ponder, self-proclaimed experts in reactive attachment disorder, from which they believed Candace suffered. Over the next 40 minutes, all captured on video, Candace begged to be set free, complained that she couldn't breathe, and even vomited and choked. The adults, deaf to her pleas, just kept taunting her. After 40 minutes, Candace went silent. And yet after that point, the adults attending her stood around chatting for another half hour. At that point, they decided to see how Candace was doing. When they unwrapped her, she was blue and not breathing. And when they checked for a pulse, nothing. Candace had asphyxiated and was later pronounced brain dead. You may think the adults in this scene were sadists, but they apparently meant well. Such is the perverse power of pseudoscience. Candace was having some behavioral problems, and her mother, a pediatric nurse, attended a conference promoting so-called attachment therapy. The idea is that children who were neglected and abused when young may fail to form a bond with their adoptive parents, resulting in behavioral problems. The therapy is intended to form such an attachment. This is, unfortunately, not the only death at the hands of this dubious therapy. According to Nancy Thomas, Parenting and Families by Design, attachment.org, a child with reactive attachment disorder needs treatment for the condition they have. Children with this disorder exhibit extreme levels of behavior and manipulation. A therapist who is not trained to deal with these extremes can do more harm than good. Reactive attachment disorder, RAD, is recognized as a psychiatric diagnosis. Like all diagnoses in DSM, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the Standard Manual of Mental Illnesses, it is based on clinical features. These features can be nonspecific, however, especially in older children, where the diagnosis is more controversial. According to the Mayo Clinic, with treatment, children with reactive attachment disorder may develop more stable and healthy relationships with caregivers and others. Treatments for reactive attachment disorder include psychological counseling, parent or caregiver counseling, and education, learning positive child and caregiver interactions, and creating a stable, nurturing environment. You will notice that nowhere in that description of standard treatment is wrapping the child in a sheet so they can't breathe. Self-described attachment therapists employ a controversial theory and derived treatments for RAD that are not supported by published science. But they feel that they're uniquely qualified to treat children with this diagnosis. Further, they tend to subscribe to the concept of RAD that sees such children as manipulative. While this may be true, it's very tricky to determine if somebody is truly being manipulative, and professionals know to be particularly careful and skeptical when making such a determination. The problem is that the conclusion that someone is, quote, manipulative can be self-fulfilling. Any behavior can be perceived as manipulative. In this way, it's like a conspiracy theory. any counter-evidence or lack of evidence is just more evidence of manipulation. This is exactly what happened to poor Candace. Convinced by the seminar that Candace had RAD and needed attachment therapy, her mother brought her to Evergreen, Colorado, for 2 weeks of intensive attachment therapy. During treatment sessions, Jean would lie on top of her much smaller daughter to restrain her while she licked her face. Candace would have her face held while therapists screamed at her. These interventions culminated in the rebirthing therapy, in which Candace was wrapped in a sheet, simulating the birth canal so that she could be, quote, reborn. What I think this case most represents is the absolute hubris of many gurus. Those practicing on the fringe think they have a special gift, talent, or insight. They don't need scientific evidence because they have intuition. They don't need to follow standards of safety, informed consent, evidence-based medicine, or even basic ethics because they are healers. Professions have standards for a reason. And that is at the core of what makes them professional in the first place. In the case of Candace, her therapists ignored basic safety standards because they were so cocky about their diagnosis and their methods. They interpreted Candace's pleas as manipulation. Her insistence that she couldn't breathe and her subsequent silence were just more of the same. One clear lesson my decades of medical experience have taught me is the need for humility. Our collective knowledge is imperfect, and my individual knowledge is imperfect. We have to try our best and double-check our understanding, be careful with our interventions, and always put the patient's interests first. Candace was killed largely by the unchecked arrogance of those who promised to treat her. On April 21st, 2001, Connell Watkins and Julie Ponder were convicted of reckless child abuse and sentenced to 16 years in prison in the death of Candace. Section 5. Changing Yourself and the World. Hopefully this has been a fun and fascinating adventure through the vagaries of human psychology and the challenges this creates for our humble species. While I think these topics are endlessly interesting, the real purpose is to apply them to your life. I know this brings us dangerously close to being a self-help book, but let me make one thing perfectly clear. This is not an effing self-help book. Think of critical thinking more as an applied science, like medicine. I love learning about the body, and especially the brain, but it's all the more interesting when you try to put that knowledge to practical use. It makes it real, not just abstract or hypothetical. So how do we do that? How do we live a skeptical life? Some version of this question is by far the most common question we get from our listeners. They want to know how to apply some aspect of skeptical thinking to a specific problem in their life. In the following chapters, we will put all this critical thinking stuff to personal use as people, as parents, and as members of society. This may be the most challenging section, because it takes critical thinking out of the abstract, out of the many examples we have given throughout the audiobook, and points skepticism directly at you, the listener. But don't worry, this part will be fun too. Chapter 56, Being Skeptical. You look at science, or at least talk of it, as some sort of demoralizing invention of man, something apart from real life, and which must be cautiously guarded and kept separate from everyday existence. But science and everyday life cannot and should not be separated. Rosalind Franklin. The first rule of skepticism is not that we never talk about skepticism. Talk about it as much as you want. The first rule is to apply these principles of critical thinking to yourself foremost. Remember all the cognitive biases, flaws in memory and perception, heuristics, motivated reasoning, the Dunning-Kruger effect. It all applies to you, not just other people. Really let that sink in. These concepts are not weapons to attack other people and make yourself feel superior. They're the tools you need to minimize the bias, error, and nonsense clogging up your own brain. realize that you will never achieve the goal of ridding yourself of bias and error. All you can do is remain vigilant and work hard to keep them to a minimum. And while you're keeping that light focused inward, recognize that you have sacred cows, ideas that are part of your identity and will cause you emotional pain to change. Rather than try to deny your humanity, embrace it and work with it. For me, this meant taking pride in being able to change my mind. I identify with a skeptical and critical process of approaching claims, of letting the facts be supreme, of being honest, fair, and transparent. That is my identity, not any particular belief or conclusion. Therefore, if I'm wrong about something, that just gives me the opportunity to change my mind and show that I can correct error. It's not easy. Being wrong will still hurt the ego. You need to get to a place where refusing to correct an error will hurt more. When it comes to dealing with other people, I would not presume to tell you what you should do. I can only tell you my approach, the SGU approach, and how that has worked out. I remind myself that we're all flawed humans just trying to get by in a complex and often scary world. We are mostly the products of our circumstances. For example, most people will end up accepting the belief system they are born to, so it hardly seems fair to blame people for the one thing in their life they had zero control over, the situation into which they were born. We're all the product of our opportunities, our mentors, and our peers, in addition to the neurological proclivities with which we were endowed. This attitude helps me to be less judgmental. I prefer to take a nurturing approach. I am happy with where I am in my life, and I owe a huge debt of gratitude to everyone who nurtured and taught me along the way. I feel the best thing I can do in return is to mentor and nurture others. This does not mean I don't hold people responsible for their actions. Con artists never cease to anger me, and I think they deserve to be punished. But on the SGU, we address beliefs and arguments, and we try hard not to attack the believers. They're just flawed people like us. On the other hand, we will criticize the purveyors of nonsense who are spreading misinformation, lies, and pseudoscience. They stepped into the public arena to promote their nonsense, and so they're fair game for scrutiny, skeptical analysis, and rebuttal. Even still, we always try to be fair. Other proponents of science and reason prefer to take a harder-edged approach, and that's fine. Whatever works for your talents and personality. I can't prove that one approach works better than another. I do suggest that if you are trying to change the minds of other people or spread your worldview, you at least think about your strategy and monitor your results. Your instincts may or may not be serving you well, so apply some of that critical thinking to how you spread critical thinking. If my first suggestion, therefore, was to be humble, and my second suggestion was to be nurturing, my third is to be courageous. It can be difficult and uncomfortable to challenge other people's beliefs or to push back against pseudoscience. One common question we get is what to do when you are sitting in a doctor's office and they are recommending pure nonsense, like homeopathy. It might be easy just to say thank you and never return, but then you're missing an opportunity to give that professional some valuable feedback. They need to know what you think about their suggestion, that you value science-based medicine, and that is what you expect from your physician. You may still decide not to return, but you've dropped a little bit of critical thinking into the world, and it all adds up. The same goes for your teachers or your kids' school, for your workplace, or for your social circle. You can remain polite if you don't like confrontation, but I would never be afraid to stand up for reason. Of course, use judgment when choosing your time and place, and know when to back off. There's courageous, and then there is a pain in the ass. If your company takes a contract from a charlatan, do you just keep your head down and do your work, or do you say something to your boss? That depends on a lot of variables, but I wouldn't rule out raising the question of where the company's responsibility lies. The way I see it, every social circle can use its own skeptic. That person who will give the skeptical point of view on any topic. Before long, people will come to you to ask what the skeptic thinks, and they will know what to expect, so they won't necessarily be put off. When you decide to engage, then really engage. Don't just give your opinion. Find out what they think and why. Address their narrative and their understanding of the topic. If you don't have a good answer to something, that is a great opportunity to say you don't know and then find out together. The best thing you can do is not just to give them a skeptical answer, but to model for them how to work it out for themselves. We really try to do this in the SGU, not tell people what to think, but teach them how to think. Show them the process, messy as it is. Science is messy. Thinking for yourself is an endless freak show. But you work through to at least a reasonable tentative answer by following a logical process that respects facts and accuracy. Skepticism is also fun and empowering. One of the most common bits of feedback we get from listeners is that they finally shed a belief system and how liberating it is. They don't have to labor under an oppressive belief anymore. They can think freely and only believe what actually makes sense to them. I like showing other people how much I enjoy being skeptical. Sure, it can be frustrating to deal with the abject nonsense that plagues our species. But in the end, it's a lot of fun to explore interesting questions, exchange ideas with people who disagree with you, and learn more about yourself and the universe. Being skeptical can't be all negative. It needs to be positive, too. I think that's why Carl Sagan is so universally respected among skeptics and science communicators. More than anyone else, he embodied that sweet spot of opposing pseudoscience while embracing the wonder and magic of a scientific view of the universe. Science can give you a perspective that is just as mind-blowing and far more wondrous than any fantasy. How to talk to friends and family. There was a time when Sunday dinner at the Novella House wasn't over until our sister ran crying from the room. A simple disagreement over a little thing, like the nature of reality and the existence of an afterlife, would somehow become personal. At one point, I was banned from Seder dinner with Evan's family just because I wrote something about his sister believing in ghosts. Kara even broke it off with a boyfriend because of his anti-vaccine and alternative medicine views. We've all been there. No one can push your buttons like family and those close to you. You also have a lot more invested in relationships you are likely to maintain for a lifetime and you want to keep for a lifetime. The stakes are higher. We're not just talking about whether the Loch Ness Monster likely exists. We're often confronting serious life decisions. We get questions from listeners whose spouses have cancer and are considering not going through with the recommended treatment in favor of vitamins or coffee enemas. Parents who want to treat their children with homeopathy, or people whose siblings are investing heavily in multi-level marketing schemes. These conversations can be truly frustrating with friends and family. During a disagreement, it's rare to get the response you want. Don't expect people to say, "You know, I never thought of it that way," or, "I really can't argue against what you're saying." Chances are you will be met with defense, misdirection, and even personal attacks. You may also return to the topic months later and find that nothing has changed, as if your prior discussions hadn't even occurred. By now, at least this shouldn't be a surprise. We reviewed a long list of psychological mechanisms that seem to conspire to maintain our existing beliefs, or the beliefs we desire. We tend to resist changing core or valued beliefs with every ounce of our will. When dealing with people close to you, it's especially important to remember the previous advice. To keep humble, patient, and focused on educating rather than just winning an argument. And remember that sometimes you may in fact be wrong. Always consider that possibility first. The long game. When people ask us for specific advice about how to deal with a family member or friend, we always say that it depends. It depends first on your goals. That may seem obvious, but it's important to consider exactly what you want to get out of the interaction. Who is your real audience? And are you trying to change opinions or behavior? Second, how much time and effort are you willing to invest? If you are chatting with someone on social media, you will probably never meet them or have a relationship. And therefore, you may be satisfied making a few pithy points and then going to get pizza. When dealing with a spouse, however, you may be willing to invest literally years of effort to slowly change their worldview. This means you need to be incredibly patient. don't expect the scales to suddenly fall from their eyes. So how do you do this? 1. As we're fond of saying on the SGU, plant the seed. Just leave the other person with a question or a thought and invite them to think about it or investigate further.